Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Well, this work week started out a little easier than most, thanks to that extra hour of sleep we all receive with the end of daylight savings time. And Americans need it. According to my guest today, Americans are chronically sleep deprived. Fully two-thirds of us don't get the recommended 8 hours a night, and sleep is important. It enhances memory, makes you more creative, delays aging's effects, keeps you slim and lowers food cravings, protects you from cancer and Alzheimer's, wards off colds and flu, lowers your risk of heart attack, stroke, and diabetes, and it abates depression and anxiety. And sleep deprivation, that's getting less than 7 hours a night, is one of the most important predictors of illness. Dr. Matthew Walker is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California at Berkeley and director of their Sleep Neuroimaging Laboratory, and is one of the foremost researchers on the needs and benefits of healthful sleep. His new book explains the how and why of why sleep is important, why we sleep, unlocking the power of sleep and dreams. It's a primer on the latest scientific research, the health benefits of a full 8 hours, the detriments of less sleep, why we have trouble sleeping, and the role dreams play in our brain and mental health. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Matthew Walker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Your book is filled with good information about developing great sleep habits. The title says, Why We Sleep. Your book asks, why do we sleep? But you write that that's not really the right question. What is the right question about sleep?
Well, it was the wrong question in a sense because it suggested that there was one single reason why we sleep. And it was a failing of the research field. We went in search of this one holy grail reason. And it turns out that we sleep for many different reasons, not just for one particular benefit or function. And in truth, that shouldn't surprise us, because when we think about it, for the two-thirds of our life that we spend awake, we're not just awake for one particular benefit, we acquire lots of different functional benefits from being awake. Why wouldn't the same logic and reason also be true for that one third of our life that we spend sleeping? And in fact, it is true. There are a whole constellation of nighttime benefits that you get from sleep, both upstairs within the brain and downstairs within the body. It's quite a remarkable elixir of life in so many ways.
It goes from everything from oxygenating our eyeballs?
That was one of the theories, because there is a stage of sleep called rapid eye movement sleep or REM sleep, and that's the stage in which we dream. And your body is actually paralyzed when you dream, and it allows your mind to safely express all of those dreams without acting them out, because you would probably be popped out of the gene pool very quickly if you started acting out your dreams. But the one muscle group that doesn't undergo paralysis, other than the basic muscle groups like respiration, are your eyes. They dart back and forth. And so at one time, there was a theory that we sleep to have these darting eye movements that oxygenate the eyeball, because movement actually helps that oxygenation. But that isn't actually the reason why we sleep.
So what is the benefits? Obviously, we're relaxing and... But all of our organs are rejuvenating during sleep. Give us a rundown of sort of the physiological benefits.
Yeah, the finger buffet of top critical benefits that you get from sleep. Well, firstly, sleep is actually not a passive state. Many of us think of it like that because we're not moving, we're not awake, and we just think the body lies dormant and nothing goes really on in the mind. It couldn't be further from the truth. Firstly, upstairs in the brain, it's an incredibly active state, and there are some stages of sleep where parts of your brain are up to 30% more active than when you're awake, just to emphasize how active a state it is. What are the benefits? Well, certainly upstairs in the mind, we know that sleep will actually help save new memories that you've recently acquired. Sleep actually future-proofs that information, and it cements those facts into the brain. It also prepares other memory structures in the brain so that when you wake up the next day, you can actually start imprinting fresh information into the brain. So it's almost like a dry sponge when you wake up, and you can soak up all of that new information. Sleep also helps regulate our emotions, and it essentially sort of resets the magnetic north of your emotional compass, enhancing positive emotions and dissipating the negative difficult emotions. We also know that sleep in the brain helps cleanse it from metabolic toxic products that build up while we're awake. And that's especially important because one of those toxic elements is a protein called beta amyloid, which is a leading cause of Alzheimer's disease. And this is why if you're not getting sufficient sleep across your lifespan, it is a marked and significant risk factor for the development of Alzheimer's disease. Downstairs in the body, sleep is just as important. Sleep actually reboots your immune system. It amplifies and boosts all of the wonderful immune-fighting arsenal within your body. Sleep, particularly deep sleep, actually, is perhaps the most wonderful form of blood pressure medication, it turns out. It drops your blood pressure. It lowers your heart rate so that you stay away from that path of hypertension. It's also important for your metabolic system. One of the things that sleep does very well is actually rebalance your appetite hormones so that you don't overeat the next day. And when you do eat, sleep actually helps a hormone that makes you feel satisfied with your food. So it keeps hunger at bay in that way. And that's why if you're not getting enough sleep, you're far more likely to overeat and become obese. Finally, it also regulates your blood glucose in wonderful ways. And we also know, once again, that 1 week of short sleep will disrupt your blood glucose so profoundly that your doctor at the end of that week would classify you as being pre-diabetic. So lots of brain and body health benefits by way of sleep. And I hope that gives the listeners a broad collection of the many reasons why we sleep rather than the single reason why we sleep.
And 8 hours is the optimal? Or is it vary from individual to individual?
Well, there's certainly variability, and it's a little bit like calories. You know, I could say 2,000 calories is a good target for your average adult male, but that will be different based on each person's physiology and even what they themselves have been doing during the day. And sleep is like that too. So there is a range. It's probably about 7.5 to 9.5 hours of sleep. We certainly know that when you go below 7 hours of sleep, most adults will demonstrate significant impairments in their brain and their bodies. We can measure those scientifically within a laboratory, and that's why the recommendation is to really get consistently more than 7 hours of sleep. And I should note, by the way, to get 7 hours of sleep, you need to be in bed for at least 7.5 hours of sleep, because most people, when you switch the light off, they don't just fall asleep and then stay asleep for 100% of that time. It takes us a while to fall asleep. Maybe we wake up. So to get 7 hours of sleep, you need to be in bed for about 7.5.
And when you go below that 7 hour threshold, you begin to see impairments of all those benefits you're talking about that sleep provides?
Yeah, that's right. We do, sadly. And that's why people who say, you know, I can survive on 6 hours of sleep or 5 hours of sleep, it's unfortunately not true. And part of the reason that people believe that, by the way, is not necessarily because they're being disingenuous. Your subjective sense of how well you're doing without enough sleep is actually a miserable predictor of objectively how you're doing without sufficient sleep. So I suppose the analogy would be, you know, a drunk driver at a bar. They've had 6 or 7 drinks and they pick up their car keys and they say, you know, I'm fine to drive home. And your response would be, you know, no, I know that you think subjectively that you're fine to drive, but trust me, objectively, you're not. You are impaired. And it's unfortunately the same problem with a lack of sleep. And that's why so many people walk sleeplessly throughout their lives, never understanding the continuing debt that they're building. And as a consequence, the disease and sickness risk that they are developing.
Now, you know, a lot of societies at one point had the afternoon siesta or nap. Does it make a difference if we have one solid sleep or a period of maybe lesser sleep overnight and a 30 to 60 minute nap through the day? What's the research on that?
Yeah, and the book discusses this in detail, which is sort of the evolution of human sleep and the anthropological studies that have been done. It's quite fascinating. We may actually not be sleeping the way that we were designed to, because if you actually look at hunter-gatherer tribes, whose way of life hasn't changed for thousands of years, they don't sleep like we sleep. They will actually take one quite long bout at night from about 9:30, 10 through until just before dawn, and they get about 6.5, 7 hours of sleep. And then they will have this sort of siesta-like nap in the afternoon. especially during the hot, dry season of the summer. And it turns out, by the way, that most of us have a genetically hardwired drop in our alertness right around that time, sometime between about 1 to 4 p.m. in the afternoon. And it's the reason that, you know, you start to see those bobbing heads around meeting tables or at that time. They're not listening to good music. And it has nothing to do with your lunch, by the way. People think that you can stop people eating and they still have that drop in alertness. So it actually seems to be that we were designed to sleep in two phases, what's called biphasic sleep, rather than one phase of sleep. So I think there's precedent for that. I would say, by the way, though, that naps are a double-edged sword and you have to be a bit careful with them. We've done lots of studies at my sleep center and we find that naps do have nice benefits as well. But during the day, we build up healthy sleep pressure. And the longer that we're awake, the more of that sleepiness that we have. And that helps us fall asleep and stay asleep at night. But if you take a nap during the day, it's almost like the pressure valve on a pressure cooker. You release some of that healthy sleepiness so that when it comes time to fall asleep at night, you struggle with sleep. So I think the advice really is, if you don't have any problems with sleep at night and you can nap regularly, then naps are just fine. But if you do struggle with sleep, then the best advice is don't nap during the day. Build up all of that healthy sleep pressure, and it will help you get a better night's sleep.
You know, when you look at a lot of mammalian species, they do take naps in the afternoon. It's sort of with the afternoon sun, there's a nap. It makes sense that we were evolutionarily designed to have two phases of sleep. One thing the book does is it talks about the evolutionary need for sleep, and you look at differences in animals and other mammals. Are there any noted differences?
There are some remarkable differences in sleep across species, both in the amount of sleep, how sleep is obtained. So, for example, some animals will have 5 or 6 bouts of sleep across the 24-hour period. You know, dogs and cats are very much like that. We also know that some species will actually sleep or can sleep with half a brain. So all birds and all aquatic mammals, like dolphins, for example, they can actually sleep with half a brain and then they switch and the other half of the brain takes a turn. Do we have that? No, we don't, or at least we didn't think that humans could sleep with half a brain until about 6 months ago. And it seems as though we have a very mild version of this, where if you sleep in a strange location, let's say you go to a hotel room and the first night, one half of your brain doesn't go as deep into sleep as the other half of the brain. And it's almost as though one half of the brain remains a little bit more vigilant and it stands on guard. So we may actually have a very kind of a diet version of what's called unihemispheric sleep. We also know that there's remarkable differences in sleep amounts. For example, elephants and giraffes, they actually sleep very little, maybe just 4 or 5 hours. The little brown bat is my hero within the animal kingdom. It sleeps almost 19 hours a day, which is great. Human beings, we actually sit right in the middle of the distribution of sleep across species, which suggests that there's nothing special about us. But that's actually not true, because if you look at the different types of sleep, and there are two main types. One is called non-rapid eye movement sleep, or non-REM. The other is called rapid eye movement sleep, or REM sleep. Within mammalian species, and specifically within primates, we are unique among primates. It's not that we sleep more than other primates, but the amount, the proportion of dream sleep that we get is almost double that of any other primate. So there's something very special about humans within the primate phylum that we don't quite yet understand, but we dream almost twice as much as any other of our sort of primate forebears. Fascinating studies there. And that all, I have a number of suggested theories as to why in the book that's the case.
We'll get to that in just a second. I do want to stress, though, that there are some animals that demonstrate some remarkable resilience at not sleeping. You describe whale species, killer whale species, I think they go, what, a month or two without any sort of recognizable sleep right after they give birth?
That's true. I should note, by the way, firstly, however, that human beings are the only species that deliberately deprives itself of sleep for no apparent good reason. And it is a striking anomaly. There are very rare occasions across the animal kingdom where we do see sleep deprivation, and perhaps the most prominent example is killer whales, particularly killer whale mothers who have just given birth to a calf. At that stage, they actually swim away from the pod, the principal pod, the tribe, to give birth. So they're desperately vulnerable with the young calf, and they will actually try to stay awake to protect the calf, and they can stay awake for several weeks, it seems, during that protection phase. We also know that there is a sparrow, the white-crowned sparrow, it turns out, during its migration period, it can actually go long stretches without getting the sleep that it normally obtains, and it doesn't seem to become impaired. However, if you then take that same bird and sleep deprive it for the same amount outside of its migratory phase, it shows remarkable impairments in the brain and the body. So there's something in this tiny little passerine bird that is deployed during the migration phase that protects it against sleep deprivation. And of course, this is the reason why the U.S. military has actually invested millions of dollars trying to discover what that special sort of cloak of sleep deprivation armor actually is, for all of the reasons that you could imagine.
Right. My guest today is Matthew Walker. He's a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California at Berkeley and director of their Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab. He's the author of Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. It's published by Scribner's. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You mentioned, so, you know, humans are the only animal species that will willingly deprive themselves of sleep. And in certain locations, I wanted to ask you this, it's almost like a badge of honor. Why do we suppose that we are proud of the fact that we're depriving ourselves of sleep?
It is a very strange point of view, you're right, and I think it really emphasizes the fact that sleep has an image problem in society in this current day and age, because we actually stigmatize sufficient sleep. We give it this label of sort of people being sloths or people who are lazy. Why is that? I still struggle to understand it. I think part of the reason is that one way to show that you're busy is to describe how little sleep that you're getting. And the reason that we want to seem busy is because we equate busyness with importance in this day and age. So, you know, some people bragging about how little sleep that they get could actually be that wanting to express busyness and wanting to express importance. What's strange to me, however, is that we don't always have that opinion, because I don't think anyone looks at an infant during the day and says, you know, oh, what a lazy baby. And the reason is because we know at that time of life, sleep is non-negotiably, absolutely, vitally necessary. But what's very sad in developed nations right now is that very quickly after infancy, even now it seems into childhood, not only do we abandon the notion that sleep is important and should be celebrated and embraced, we actually chastise people for getting sufficient sleep. So something needs to change in society at that level, too, to bend the arrow of this global sleep loss epidemic back on itself and put us back into a healthy profile of sufficient sleep.
Coming out of that, you have a big discussion about morning larks and night owls, and, of course, how our society is really based on early risers. What about the idea of having more flexible work schooling hours for people who work better on a night owl schedule? And you've documented those people do exist. There are people who are, I guess, genetically predisposed to waking up early, others to to sleeping late.
Yeah, so we actually call them owls and larks. So these are the morning types and the evening types. Evening types want to go to bed late and wake up late. Morning types, they want to get up early and go to bed early. And society heavily biases the praising of those morning types. And it actually, again, suggests that the evening types are those lazy types who can't get up in the morning early. It's actually not their fault. It's genetically determined. It's called your chronotype. And we know the genes that dictate your evening eveningness or your morningness. And I think society needs to be very flexible because it turns out that evening types are chronically underslept. They are at far higher rates of many of the diseases that we spoke about, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, obesity. And something I think needs to be altered in how we work within society. It also needs to change, however, within education, which you mentioned too.
Yes.
Because even within an individual across a lifespan, your preference for going to bed changes. So when you're young, you go to bed early, you wake up early. But during adolescence, there's a remarkable shift where you fast forward in time and you now are genetically, physiologically wired to go to bed late and wake up late. So it's not a teenager's fault that they can't wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning to get to school because it starts at 7:30 and act with grace and humility and learn effectively. It's like asking an adult to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and sit down in a classroom at 4:30 in the morning and start to learn effectively and be in a good mood. They can't do it. And we know that several counties throughout the United States have shifted their school start times, and the transformation is unequivocal. We see that academic grades increase, behavioral problems decrease, truancy rates actually decrease, and psychological and psychiatric issues decrease. We also know that life expectancies increase because there is a remarkable drop in road traffic accidents in those teenagers because they're not sleeping behind the wheel. So if our goal as educators truly is to educate and not risk lives in the process, then I fear that we are failing our children in a quite spectacular manner with this model of incessant early school start times.
And this research is not new. This has been, we've known this for a long time, and yet schools and our culture resist this change for the most part.
It does. And I think there are understandable reasons. You know, I don't want to sound sort of too evangelical about that. I'm not immune to the practicalities of this because there are two essential reasons. One is that parents need to get to work on time. So hence, children need to be, you know, deposited at schools earlier before they get to work. Otherwise, they're late at work. And then the second is, you know, bus unions, that they have their schedules and they are somewhat inflexible. And I think that they're all very understandable reasons for why this is happening, but they are not excuses for this happening. And this is our next generation.
Oh.
What are we doing? We still need to solve this. You know, we've put people on the moon. I think we can solve this.
My guest today is the author of Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Powers of Sleep and Dreams, Matthew Walker, a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the director of their Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab. Well, there's so much to talk about. We're running out of time. The section on dreams is really interesting about why we do dream more than any other animal species and why they are important. But I want to talk about whether it's aging or our crazy pace that we go at in contemporary life, some factors in the changing nature of sleep. And you've mentioned five that are big ones. The constant electric light, a regularized temperature, that plays a role in our ability to get good sleep at night. Caffeine, alcohol, and then alarms. Can you talk a little bit about these five factors?
Yes. So these are sort of tips that can actually help people start to get better sleep beyond obviously just prioritizing an 8-hour non-negotiable episode each night. The first is regularity. So try to go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time, no matter whether it's the weekday or the weekend. And regularity is a real key to good sleep. The second one is darkness, because we are, I think, a dark-deprived society, and we need more darkness at night to allow the rise of a hormone called melatonin, which helps time the healthy onset of your sleep. So shutting down laptops in the last hour before bed, you know, you don't need all of the lights on in the house, maybe switch half of them off, that will help you as well. And temperature is one that's probably misunderstood by most, or perhaps not even thought about. Your body needs to drop its temperature by several degrees Fahrenheit to fall asleep. So you can help it do that by keeping your bedroom cool. Somewhere in the region of about 68 degrees seems to be optimal. If you get cold feet and that you don't like that, you can put socks on. That's fine. But keep the bedroom cool. to help take your body in the right direction for healthy sleep. Alcohol and caffeine, this makes me so unpopular. People kind of really dislike me after hearing this, but I can't tell you untruths. This is a science. Caffeine, many people know that it keeps you awake, of course, but some people will actually say, well, I can have a cup of coffee with dinner, and I fall asleep fine, and I stay asleep, so no problem. It is a problem because even if that's true, when caffeine is swirling around within the brain, the depth of the deep sleep that you have isn't as deep compared to if you didn't have that cup of coffee. And you will then wake up the next day and you'll feel unrefreshed, but you don't link the two together. You think, well, I fell asleep fine and I stayed asleep, so it wasn't the coffee. But now you're reaching for two cups of coffee in the morning rather than one, so you develop a dependency. It's an addiction cycle. Alcohol, I'm so sorry, but most people think a nightcap helps. That's not true. Alcohol is a sedative, and sedation is not sleep. So you're just knocking out your cortex in the brain when you have a nightcap. Alcohol is also a problem for two other reasons. Firstly, alcohol will fragment your sleep. And what I mean by that is you'll wake up many more times throughout the night, and therefore you won't feel restored by the sleep that you've had when you wake up. And sadly, finally, alcohol is actually very effective at blocking your dream sleep. And dream sleep is essential for numerous aspects of brain health. So those would be the suggestions. I know that for many people, they're probably not great news, but if you follow them, it's very likely that you'll start to have a better night of sleep.
Now, you also mentioned alarms as being a problem. Is it and the snooze button, I think, is perhaps.
Yeah. So I'll mention that just before I go. And I think the alarms are useful to help you get up and keep your sleep regular. So I'm not against necessarily an alarm, but don't use the snooze button, because when that alarm goes off, there's actually quite a spike in your cardiovascular system. Blood pressure is increased, heart rate is increased. And to repeatedly inflict that insult to your heart by, you know, hitting the snooze button, doing it again, hitting the snooze button, doing it again, it sounds trivial for one day. But if you do it every day, every month, every year, you can imagine that it actually, it's like compounding interest. It starts to escalate.
Matthew Walker, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Sleep well.
Matthew Walker is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California at Berkeley and director of their Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory. He's also the author of Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.